At item number 8, educational presentation from Veris on transition management and transition cost analysis.
Ed? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, everyone. Great to see you again. Happy New Year. Hope 2016 is off to a good start for you. We have a couple education sessions today. So as you mentioned, the next item is on transition management, transaction cost, and then we'll follow that up with cash overlay. I asked Tim to join me for this just because it's educational. Wanted to just, you know, rely on your past experiences and other reference points that might be helpful as we talk through this. I think the concepts are straightforward enough, and so I think we can just dive into the materials and walk right through it. So if you take a look at the first one on transition management and transaction cost analysis, on page 2, we outline the session goals here. And first is just to provide the education and increase familiarity. And then we're going to ask you to provide guidance, which is actually a separate agenda item, item 9, for us to take the next steps to review capable service providers and eventually come back to you with a recommendation. That'll probably take a couple months. I would imagine that recommendation would come back to you at the March meeting, knowing that February is a fairly full agenda. It'll take us a bit of time to do the work, and probably best suited to come back to you in March would be my guess. If we turn forward a couple pages from that, page 5 gives us the conceptual issue that we're trying to solve here. And this ties to both transition management and transaction cost analysis, which on this page on the left-hand side we label trade cost analysis, same thing. Transition management has to do with one-time events where we're taking large portions of the portfolio and making a wholesale change in some direction. Perhaps it's just a change of managers from similar strategy, but just a change with the managers who are overseeing that strategy. Or as we're talking about now, we have a big rebalancing coming up as we adopt the FFP program and not start to implement it. There are going to be some moving pieces here. And so transition management can come into play in terms of minimizing the costs. And this iceberg picture is what we're really focusing on, because in many ways it is like an iceberg. Taxes aren't a big concern for us, right? We're a public plan. A pension plan. Commissions at the top, which are visible and something we typically do see and are easily monitored, are under a lot of pressure, and they have been for decades now. So the commissions continue to come down and down and down, which is great. Reduces our fees. And we can see those easily. The parts underneath the water that we can't see as well are things like market impact, what happens by virtue of us selling or buying securities, what impact does that have in and of itself on the price of the securities. The spread, which is the bid-ask spread, these are the prices, the bid and the ask, between what you buy a security for and what you sell a security for. And this is one of the greatly masked portions of our industry, where what that spread looks like during times of market duress can really widen out. And so what you have to pay for the same security due to the bid-ask spread can have a real impact. And so being able to monitor that and shed some light on it and understand it, have the transparency really, is a key component that transition management and transaction cost analysis help us get our arms around. And then opportunity costs, this is almost a philosophical kind of discussion. What else could we be doing with the money? So that one is at the bottom of the iceberg. That one really is hard to estimate. But between market impact and spread, there are firms who can help us get our arms around these numbers and help manage these processes better with our existing managers or between transitions among managers. Does that all make sense? Let me just pause there.
So there's an iceberg.
There's an iceberg. We're getting right to it.
We're not the Titanic, right?
Infrastructure.
I'm sorry? And we're not the Titanic, right? So page 9 highlights a couple important considerations. And on page 9, we start on the left-hand side with the legacy portfolio, which is essentially where we are today. I'm sorry, 7. Thank you. The legacy portfolio of where we are today and the target portfolio of where we're going. And we introduce a transition manager is going to introduce a transition account at the custodian that will be set up for this purpose to manage the securities to and from. And then the tools that they have available are these boxes here, starting with in-kind transfer. The easiest, cheapest, quickest way is to do an in-kind transfer, meaning that if manager A has the stock and manager B wants that stock, then there's nothing to buy or sell. And if we were to just invest in mutual funds, for example, that mutual fund would sell out of that position and the new mutual fund would buy that position. We don't want to do that. And so we can be more smart and more effective operationally by having that stock just transfer in kind. So that's the ideal. Aside from that, then, we get into the crossing networks, internal and external, and that's where the transition manager can look at all of the buys and sells they have going on throughout their whole book of business over here, or all the buys and all the sells, and look at what is going on among their positions and cross them and say, oh, okay, well, this group wants to buy and this group wants to sell it. We don't have to trade that on an exchange then. We can just cross it internally. Externally, they can do it with other managers. They have to show the portfolio, and so they do give up some of that transparency of what you're interested in buying and selling to others to do it, but it is still a cheaper, more effective way than transacting on the market. So that creates that opportunity. And then futures and currency trading and open market agency trades. We don't do a lot in currency. I wouldn't expect a lot in futures. May come into play in fixed income to some extent. And open market agency trades are where they're actually just placing the trades then. And what they do there is they work to ensure that they are getting best execution with closest spreads and monitor that closely. So as we jump ahead then to page 9, we have a nice outline of why transition management really does make sense. And on this page, the schematic here is taking a look at the legacy manager, what their strengths and focus and incentives are, the target manager, who's going to be receiving the new account, and then what the transition manager does. And so as we go through line by line, accountability, straightforward enough, alignment of interests, and I think this one is interesting, that the transition manager, you're hiring a transition manager or employing them and reaching an agreement that they want to get best execution for you. The legacy manager doesn't have as much incentive to get best execution for you anymore. Keep in mind, they're your legacy manager. They're not going to be your future. The new manager doesn't have much either. They're kind of getting the portfolio, so where are their interests? Just whatever they receive is fine by them, and they can place those trades. The transition manager actually is the one with accountability there. Also, a couple lines down below that, execution. Transition managers specialize in high-volume trades. They're good at this. A lot of the managers that we have within the portfolio, though, we tend to like lower turnover portfolios. We like strategies that are more buy and hold and stay with it. And as you would expect, their shops are designed to do less trading activity, not more. And so as a result, when they do trade, they tend to have a trader or group of traders in the office that can execute these. A transition manager is solely focused on trading, and they have the strength and capabilities to do this in big numbers. Thus, internal crossing networks, external crossing networks, they have those tool sets to bring to bear. And then a couple lines below that, analysis and reporting. So here, again, we get detailed pre-trade analysis and extensive post-trade analysis so we can really track what happened and how it transpired, whereas the others just aren't going to give us that transparency. Now, page 10 brings to light some of the black eyes that the industry has suffered over the recent time periods. There are a couple issues here that we point out. State Street UK, where it really was focused in the UK, had a couple issues that come out in 2010 and 11. And then we see them again in 2014. Both of these are tied to the UK. And it gives us some pause with State Street because the issues that they had related to the UK, but the FCA's findings were that the UK division wasn't properly overseen by their more global group, their PSA group, I believe was the acronym for it. And as a result, it kind of raises questions about, well, what else weren't they overseeing properly? Like, just didn't give us a lot of confidence behind that. And so our research team has looked at it and said, okay, recognizing that State Street is your custodian, and your custodian is often in the best position to provide transition management if they have that capability, it's naturally a first extension to find out what your custodian can do for you. Let's make sure we ask the right questions around these issues, and let's get comfort that what they've done for you is appropriate. Now, as I understand, you've had some experience since these findings.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we've known about from the beginning. State Street has restructured the transition management group. We've been in Boston in their offices multiple occasions. They've been here. We've run, I believe, two transitions through State Street post the announcement of the UK scandal. The UK scandal was specific to fixed income trading, was specific to European-based clients, and there's a different convention about how they price transitions there. They were pricing it off yield instead of a hard cost. They were supposed to be, and they were actually passing through both. We haven't run fixed income transitions through State Street. We haven't run any non-US transitions through State Street, and we have had good execution post that. But we want Verus's opinion on what we should do going forward, because while we've had a positive experience, we want to know if there's a better, cleaner option available.
So the nature of selecting a provider here is a little bit different than selecting an investment manager. There's part of this timeline is that there's consolidation within the industry, increasing regulatory oversight required naturally as part of the banking business, a lot of scrutiny of brokerage trading operations, and so there is a shrinking list of providers here, and then we think it's even smaller as you look at who's best at doing different types of transactions.
And we really should have stated that up front. The reason we're doing this today is because there was a pool established years ago. So many of the firms exited the pool that we collapsed down to State Street was our option. And so now we're looking at seeing, do we refresh this today?
So we would think of it more like a program that if we're doing a large-scale, significant transition of the entire portfolio, we probably want this manager to do that. If we're looking at specialty in this asset class, we may want this manager to do that. And it's kind of that simple. Yeah. That's why our recommendation is really to come back to you with a program and say and create that list and analysis that way.
How long would that take? When would we expect that?
So I would expect that that's the deliverable we would bring back in March if you provide us that direction.
Ed, could you talk for a minute about sometimes there's times that you want to use a transition manager and then there's other times where you don't, it doesn't make sense. Can you just kind of give a brief overview of that?
Yeah, great question. So, the kinds of issues are that if we didn't have a program in place, I think by having a program in place, it lessens the burden. So part of it is looking at the burden to educate, to decide what the transition is that we want to do, and figure out the cost and timing involved. And sometimes if we look at a situation, we say, we need to get out of this strategy today because something significant happened at that manager, and we want to transition tomorrow. Introducing this process would add delay to it and probably cost us more than the benefit of actually just transitioning straight away as fast as we could. Completing the buys and sells with noise around those buys and sells. So in that kind of situation where it's an independent manager or an independent solution, one part of the portfolio, we could transition it a lot easier. Also with separate accounts, oftentimes we can take that separate account and just fire the manager and hire the new one into it without a lot of transition management. So those kinds of issues come into play. By having the program in place, then you have reduced the administrative burden and you can be more flexible about it going forward. And then when we have a transition change, we can say, is this a time we should enact the management or not?
So have you used the transition manager at all recently for any purpose?
It's probably been about 15 months. We haven't had a lot of public market mandates that were terminated in transition. I think the last significant transition we did was when we exited the GMO product and entered into the Pureford product, which is about 15 months ago. So during the past year where we've had the change of consultancy and the asset allocation going on, we haven't had a lot of moving pieces. So there hasn't been a lot of need for transitions.
Right.
That's really what's driven the pause more than anything else.
Frequently use a transition manager?
In the past, when we've transitioned, when you've terminated one manager and hired a new manager, that has typically gone through a transition manager.
Okay, so we have a good idea of the sample of transition managers we might be interested in?
No. As I said, our pool has dwindled through State Street, so the last several transitions have all gone through State Street. We've had a very successful track record there, but we're looking to see, can we do better than that?
Okay.
Or is that our best solution?
Right.
So on page 11, we just outlined a couple of the transition event considerations. So, Gail, I think this kind of gets to your point as well. So thinking about the concentration of the securities in the portfolio, the sub-asset classes we're working with, the overall size, trading costs, liquidity, and the timing. So those are all what would come into bear there. And then transition manager considerations, as you would expect, areas of expertise, their business model, all of their capabilities and characteristics.
Ed, what's the single biggest factor looking at the transition event considerations? What in your mind is the, maybe the single largest factor that's important to a successful transition? I haven't thought of one, but I want to know what.
Yeah, for us, so single big. There's the complexity is the key issue. I think is that if we were doing just small cap manager to small cap manager, that's not too difficult to do. The markets are generally pretty liquid, and as you time it, it can be done effectively. When you get into broader, more asset classes involved, and you're having more managers, that adds a lot of complexity where they can really bring the value.
Yeah, I was thinking that the worst thing would be to be in a hurry. In other words, to have a time, either unrealistic or otherwise, a time frame that was unrealistically short, which puts you literally at the mercy of other factors, right? All the externalities that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you may want to comment on their actual experience. What I've seen is all of the managers try to do it as quickly as possible, and that helps them eliminate the opportunity cost and trying to guess where the market is, because they don't want to be involved in where the market's going to, and they don't want to be held accountable for it. So it's their incentives are generally aligned to get it done quickly. And so if they can do the in-kinds, the crossing networks, and things like that, and get the transactions done, they will do that as fast as possible. And then the other part is the market impact while they're trading it, and they try to minimize that by doing it quickly.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the the mandate for the transition manager is to get us to our destination point. Any additional days it takes to get that, we're at the mercy of the market. We're at the mercy of not holding the portfolio we want to hold. So they tend to, as Ed said, 2-3 days for an equity transition gets the bulk of it done. What we look for is folks who, as you said, they have multiple channels to be trading against. So it's not you're taking $300 or $400 million and shoving it to the open market.
Yeah.
It's you want to see that breadth of the tool set that they can filter the portfolio through 4, 5, 6 different channels depending on where they see it advantageous to do so.
If potential transition managers have dwindled down from a larger number to one, obviously there's potential it dwindles down to zero. Do we have some kind of a risk management from our own point of view approach or reaction, or what we would do if in fact State Street decided one Monday morning we're no longer in the business?
Today?
Yeah.
I think we go to Gail's point. You always have the option of taking that portfolio and reassigning it to a new manager. The new manager tends to not have the specific expertise of trading. They tend to be long-term investors, not big traders. We always have that option. What we're trying to do here is rebuild the pool so we have a little bit more resiliency in the program today. So I think we would be highly unlikely to come back to the board and say, we recommend one firm that we push everything through. It's going to be, let's redevelop a pool so we have the ability to have multiple options in case one of them exits again or doesn't have expertise in a segment, candidly.
On that note, I'm thinking again of our new asset model, asset allocation model, and I'm wondering again, how much of a transition that'll involve? If it's going to be a large transition, have you thought about parsing it out to different expertise or transition managers who have expertise in certain areas?
Yeah, maybe you can talk about kind of four satellite approach.
Well, so I think that would be part of the plan that we would want to bring back in March is looking at that. What we look at is actually it's on, we had a separate slide on it, page 13, which I think gets to this. We have it broken out into three tiers where we have diversified transition managers. And these are some of the larger firms out there that have the breadth and scope to be able to handle an entire portfolio transition for us pretty effectively. And they could provide us with across-the-board capabilities. Custodial banks, as you have with State Street, there are others out there as well that play in this space. So we could actually hire a different bank to do it because their expertise is great in this particular area. And we can do that. And then the boutique transition managers focus on specific asset classes. And so when we come back to you, what I would envision is that given the migration to the new asset allocation is that we would look at it and say, we think the diversified transition managers are best because we're doing a large portfolio, and here's what all they would cover. And if there are carve-outs that we would say, okay, but specifically we would want to use this firm for this transition.
Sound like we're transitioning the entire portfolio, are
yeah.
we?
No, I want to answer that question as well. I mean, in the implementation plan, there will be guidance to say, based upon the operational vendors that we're trying to get in place here, based upon kind of the policy statement that will be developed through the governance review session in February and presented in March, here are the moves we can rebalance away from, you know, these are the managers that don't have a strategic role prospectively. We can take their funds down immediately and redeploy them. Here's the things that we can kind of parse out over the next 6 to 8 months. And here are longer term projects, such as building into the private equity, building into the private credit, that sort of thing. So there's going to be a, what can we do today that gets the ball rolling? What are the work products that we need to accomplish over the next few quarters to largely get there? And what are the longer term goals that it's going to take us years to get into? So there will be a parsing of it.
And I understood when we were doing the asset allocation study that it was going to take a long time. It wasn't going to happen
yeah.
as quickly as maybe we would like. But again, and it sounds like too, we may be acquiring new fund managers, giving up other fund managers.
Yeah, I think the first stage is going to be what no longer has a strategic role. So those funds can be drawn down and made immediately available. Then it's what managers can we find relatively quickly and fund them up. And you know, I think we've talked with Varis that the liquidity portfolio is the first portfolio that needs to be established. The growth portfolio can take a little bit longer, and obviously the private equity and private credit will take years to build. But it's getting that liquidity portfolio restructured is priority number one. And so it's going to be, you know, what are the sources of funds that are going to be coming into that, and we'll get the ball rolling on that as early as the second quarter here.
Okay, thanks.
SAC has put on an educational class on transition stuff. Virtus was there.
Yeah.
Where would they fit? Would they fit like in the independent or the diversified transition?
More boutique-ish. Yeah. A little smaller.
Diversified?
Scale.
Mm-hmm. Because they seem like they did, basically, that was all they did.
That's right.
And did it on multi-levels, like small and large cap.
Right. There are a few managers out there that are like that boutique, that's all they do. They aren't a custodian. They aren't
right.
part of a large
and that's,
organization.
That's,
yeah.
Are these transition managers rated?
Are they what? I'm sorry?
Rated.
Yes, they are. We'll actually get into that. Yeah.
What would the cost be, like, say something like that, using like one specific manager versus spreading it around or using a custodial bank?
Well, that would be more of like the individual strategy transition, and you'd want to line it up with their areas of expertise and be able to say like, okay, this is why we want to use you and here's the time frame for doing it, so it's not a burning bridge that we have to get out of immediately. And then we could structure an agreement with them and have them ready to go. Yeah.
So rating?
Rating.
And did they, the moment of the question, did they have better results? <that's fee-wise? laughs> I'm sorry.
I'm
sorry.
There's a firm, let's see, what page do we mention about? Did I take it out? There was a Harbor Analytics page. There's a firm called Harbor Analytics that does this. That writes the transition managers. We've seen their reports. We think it's interesting. but not conclusive.
Okay.
So it gives some insight into who's better at what.
But you don't rely on it entirely.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's somewhat hypothetical because you have what the transition manager does for you, and that's the strongest basis for the analysis. Having someone else rating that against others isn't an apples-to-apples comparison that you can just make easily. So you have to make some assumptions to do it, and thus you come back with kind of results that...
This is difficult because, I mean, the data sets are not smooth, right? By their very nature, they're engaged in episodic relationships. A client comes to them, you push something through, you have the idiosyncratic risk of what portfolio they were given, what portfolio they're delivering, and the market conditions at play during the transition. And so to take that and then try to roll it all up into a, you know, next performance number, it's just not clean. There's too many moving pieces. So this is one where you really have to parse apart, what did they say they were going to do? What did they deliver? Were there any glitches? It's a lot more qualitative. And therefore, you know, that's largely why we're saying, based upon Verisk's experience with all their client base, let them come back with what they, you know, based upon that larger data set, because they're going to have a larger data set than we ever will, right? They have multiple clients. We have one set of managers. What is the quote-unquote success and satisfaction rating of these? And so we're going to be depending on the Verisk assessment of that.
Right. And we've had situations. The nice thing about State Street is a couple of our transitions that they've run through, they've been able to just take some of our securities into their own portfolios. And so that's a unique situation of that type of manager, whereas if you have a transition manager that's not running any portfolios on their own, they've got to find other places to distribute. So, I mean, we did very well, I think. I forget which manager we had terminated, but we did very well in one trade where they were able to take a substantial amount of the inventory of our securities into their inventory, and transaction costs were like zero. And
we actually made money on the transaction costs. We don't count on that. As I said, we have had a very good track record with State Street.
Okay. Transaction cost analysis is in a similar vein, but it is more of the ongoing looking at the trades going on within your portfolio. So this is just day in, day out, how the managers are managing the portfolios. And again, on page 15, we outline these same costs that we're thinking about: commissions and taxes, markets, delay costs, and such. And so we can probably skip ahead to just transaction monitoring. And here, this just helps us keep our managers honest about getting best execution and ensuring their strategies are consistent with the investment styles. Deter soft dollar and trading abuses. Soft dollar has to do with paying extra for your trade execution because you're getting research back from them. And there's some, this used to be a much more common practice than it is today. And it used to involve much larger dollars than it does today. But that kind of thing can be an operational inefficiency in terms of that spending, and provide some insight into performance attribution and improve cost delays. So you have transaction cost managers ongoing analysis for firms that can step in and just continue to monitor it and provide you with reports. So your experience here, I think, has been largely with Milliman doing it, and there are other firms that specialize just in this capacity. So I think the Milliman report that you had in the past was useful, was interesting, but I don't know that it shed the brightest light on it, as they weren't a leading provider in the space. And there are others, like Zeno is one firm that comes to mind that focuses much more just on this. And so this is a different kind of tact, where Zeno is a company that comes to us and says, we're willing to take a look at the portfolio for 30 days. Give us a month. We'll take a look, provide you with an analysis, provide you with a report, and you get a free look as to what we can do for you. And so that kind of makes sense. I mean, why not? What's the harm in it? And it's just the ongoing management of our plan. So in that case, we'd probably look to someone like Azeno or one of the other providers and see if we could do something that like that here. You might want to talk a little bit about your experience with Milliman.
Well, with the Milliman, it was a high-level look at domestic equity trading costs versus what went on over the course of an entire day. And there was not a lot of granularity to that report. That was the industry standard report at the time. Now what we're trying to do is really shine a light on where are we getting leakages from economic. If you remember, Ashby Monk came in during our offsite workshop and talked about all the hidden costs embedded in the financial system, and a lot of that was every time you're making a transaction, somebody's taking a cut. And when we don't see that, we see the net result, we don't have great clarity on the transaction, the bid-ask spread, all the factors Ed talked about. Somebody like this who can do a deeper dive, shine a brighter light, can actually start to illuminate that, and we can take a look and say, is there a way, do we have a manager who has excessive trading costs? And it could be as simple as picking up the phone and saying, we're noticing this about your transaction activity, it is costing, you know, net returns to us, is there a different way of engaging with you? So we can start to see that data, have that conversation, and hopefully have this be a cost savings tool for the plan on a perpetual basis.
Tim, in our due diligence, do we look at soft dollars? Is it something that, on the front end, obviously, do you accept soft dollars or pay them? On an ongoing basis, look at that?
Well, I'm going to caveat that we have not run a public market search through Verra, so I will let Ed answer that on their RFPs.
Okay.
So we can. We generally don't. Most engage in it to some extent, and they're able to support it by saying the value is created by doing it. So the counter-argument to soft dollars is that, yes, we get research. Yes, we pay more. We're not going for lowest cost execution, but we get good execution, and the value of the research is there for us. So it's tough to say. At the end of the day, if their performance is good and you look at it and say it must be merited, they're getting their research somehow, some way, we support that, then it kind of makes sense because you're getting it in the performance for the plan. If the performance is down and you're not getting it, then you say, then it becomes a tougher discussion.
Yeah. And in the past, it was asked every time when it was there, if there was a conversation you had about similar along the lines of what you're saying, why are you doing it? What are you getting out of it? Show me your compliance records surrounding this level of trading. If the SEC has been in to examine you, what did they say about this? So it triggered a conversation there. I consider it to be past practice and not best practice. I think it's slowly going away, but slowly.
I always think of the Enron model, where when the research didn't meet Enron's view of what good research was, that is, it was not favorable, they made it very clear their future banking relationships with the Merrill Lynch's of the world. There were three or four named very high-profile investment firms out there named found a way to come up with the right answer for Enron, and it is a conflict that, at least in this case, it was crystal clear in hindsight.
It's really a changing landscape that we have in our industry. So we get the same questions asked of us on our OCIO business. Do we engage in soft dollar practice? And we're no, we're bright line, we won't do it. And the litmus test for us is that, okay, well, if we're getting research from anyone, we want to know that research is available to everyone. So if it's public research and it's on your website or whatever, yeah, we'll take it, we'll read it, and we take comfort that it's going out to everyone else. There are also independent research companies that have sprung up to say, okay, well, if the sell side, if Wall Street brokers aren't putting out research on the companies anymore, we'll do it for a fee. And it won't be soft dollar because you got to pay us for our research, and that's all you do is pay us for our research. So it's really led to a whole changing landscape there.
I guess I'm not viewing that as soft dollar.
That
is considered hard dollar.
Yeah. That process, the soft dollar amounts have come down because the money just isn't there to pay the Wall Street firms anymore. And so it's, The transparency has really changed a lot of the practice. So it hasn't totally gotten soft dollar practice out of the industry. It still exists, but it's much less dollars, much more limited. Today, it's probably not one of the key decision points that's going to make you either hire or fire a manager. You're probably going to look at it and say, explain it to me, give me a good explanation. And if that explanation is sound and they have the compliance checks in place, then you're probably going to get comfort that it's okay.
Okay. Rusty, do you want to ask about ratings?
So I think on this case, having someone do a free look on the portfolio is interesting, because if they're going to come to us and say, we expect, you know, our rate for this for a plan of your size would be X dollars per month or per year, however they structure it, that would help us understand if the value is really there in the first place, if there's even any potential for it. In the meantime, we get a look into how they see our portfolio. So it doesn't seem to offer much downside. And then, right. So I'd offer that, and then as the transition management, I guess, as far as the next agenda item, the direction we'd like to get is that we come back to you with a plan outlining, a program outlining how we would use specific managers under specific situations.
Are you looking for a motion? Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.